The detritus of civilization, the historical debris of bourgeois society, is the mandala of Gothic Marxism. Gothic Marxism charts the contours of a Marxist genealogy, fascinated with the irrational aspects of social progress, a genealogy that both investigates how the irrational pervades existing society and dreams of using it to affect social change. This is opposed to vulgar Marxism, which holds a deterministic and mechanical view of human development rooted in the Enlightenment. Hello, and welcome to The Regrettable Century. I'm Chris.
I'm Kevin.
I'm Jason.
And I'm Jenny.
And today we are talking about Marxist Romanticism and the Gothic strain in Marxism, or Gothic Marxism. Now, to start off, I think it's important to talk about what Gothic Marxism is not. Gothic Marxism is not a sect or current of Marxism. It is not a type of Marxism which holds any specific variations of Marxist thought.
Right. It's not like the immortal science of Marxism, Leninism, Maoism, for example.
the immortal science of Marxism, Leninism, Maoism, Murphyism, as in Peter Murphy.
It's also not Marxism for goth kids.
That's true.
All Marxism is Marxism for goth kids.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Well, I don't know. Like, a lot of goth kids are so into nihilism and death that they're drawn to the just destructive nature of fascism. Yeah.
Well, you know what Bakunin said is that the passion of destruction is a creative joy.
And you know what Peter Murphy says, and that is the passion of lovers is for death.
We're off to a really good start.
Anyway, getting back on track. Okay, so now that we've established what Gothic Marxism is not, we should probably try to get, you know, a definition of our terms. What is Gothic Marxism?
Well, going through the readings and whatever, all the stuff that we had for this episode, I couldn't help but shake the sense, because, you know, I came into this totally raw. I had encountered random bits here and there by, like, China Mieville and I don't know, whoever else, David McNally or whatever, that fit into the category of Gothic Marxism. But I'd never really considered, like, I'd never really considered this. But so going through all the readings, I was trying to get a grip on exactly what Gothic Marxism is, and it's the best. It really did come across to me as though it were doing it like a Venn diagram of Gothic and Marxism, and then like Gothic Marxism is where the two are like overlapped in the middle. Like it's Marxist cultural criticism with Gothic concerns and emphases and sensibility or whatever, and then you merge those two, and that's the area of overlap in the Venn diagram. Is that not right?
I kind of think of it as it's a clumsy, maybe historically conditioned term to account for the fact that people have wildly different ideas that they kind of fit into a broader framework, right? So, like, I don't think of it as so much as, like, a better way of thinking of this to me would be, like, instead of Gothic Marxism, which is the term that actually exists, would be the Gothic strain in Marxism, or the Romanticism, you know, innate within Marxism. So Gothic Marxism is the, let's say, sensibility that there is a Romanticism, that it's that we're basically trying to, like, uncover, that has maybe been shunted aside.
Right.
And suppressed. So because it has been shunted aside and suppressed, it has to be kind of given a more explicit category, Gothic Marxism.
Well, and I think the thing too is that it's super fair to not have like a great grasp on what it is, because I don't think tons of people do, right? So it's vocabulary that we use to describe more or less trends among particular groups of Marxists and individual Marxists, right? And the use of particular tropes to illustrate what we mean as Marxists. And I think the ability to illustrate you know, a lot of the heavier stuff that we're talking about theoretically in ways that, you know, draw from Romanticism, right? So, yeah, I mean, of course it's not going to be super crystallized because I don't know that, I think this conversation is like us figuring it out with a lot of other people right now.
Right. No, absolutely. But I mean, also there's, you know, like I was talking with my girlfriend about this, who's, she's, you know, like really into Gothic literature, as such, not so much Gothic Marxism. And she, you know, she was explaining that Gothic literature as a category is also itself a very like a hodgepodge, strange mixture of a genre of literature, that in the same way that I think both you and Jason and Jenny were just saying that what Gothic Marxism is.
Yeah, and Gothic literature, when you look at it, and that's sort of the point that we'll get to with this, is that it reflects cultural anxieties and fears differently based upon, you know, which country and which time the literature comes out of. I think that it's, like Jason said, you know, is that it's sort of like an experimental attitude, a sensibility, much like Situationism. And not necessarily a concrete formulation, but what we've got a Gothic Marxism's rubric of concerns that was given to us by Susan Cohen in her book Profane Illumination, which is about Walter Benjamin, and which I read for this.
Benjamin,
right, right. Which I read for this, but actually I grad school read it, which I don't know. Kevin knows what I'm talking about when I say grad school read.
Can't
and
relate.
For those of you who don't, grad school reading is like college reading, you know, except for on purpose. Cause you know how, like right before the essay was due, you would read the first and last sentence of every paragraph and like the intro and conclusion. And that's it. That's a grad school reading, but we do it on purpose. It's also like reading a book in high school in general, you know? So it's interesting that the more advanced your education gets, the shittier you get at actually reading and retaining information.
Yeah. Just the better you get at bullshitting, maybe. So like,
that's exactly what it is.
It's, if you read a lot of like academic, you know, texts, you really kind of want to read it in that way anyway. So you're like, all right, that's the concept and move on. Rather than actually having to ponder each word, tedious words.
I think the only person who ever needs to read an academic text is the person that's reviewing the book, because everyone else is just going to read the intro and the conclusion and the reviews of the book, and then that's it. Okay, so Gothic Marxism's rubric of concerns include the valorization of the realm of a culture's ghosts and phantasms as a significant and rich field of social production, rather than a mirage to be dispelled. And I think that is incredibly important, because that is definitely something that Marxism, in that a more vulgar and rigid mechanistic strain of Marxism would like us to do. And I think this is summed up really well in a conversation that I had once with a former comrade of mine in an organization that I used to be in, where I don't remember what the conversation was about, but somehow Star Wars came up. And this comrade goes, "Oh, you like Star Wars? Star Wars is full of a bunch of like hokey reactionary fantasy bullshit. I like Star Trek because Star Trek is forward-looking and it gives us a vision of a socialist future."
So he was a Stalinist. Whether he recognized it or not,
she would probably flip shit if you said that to her, but
Yeah.
Well,
that is a very Stalinist way of thinking about culture. Absolutely.
I was going to say, I'm familiar with the milieu from which you came.
Oh, are you now?
I would say that whether these comrades realized it or not is immaterial, but that actually that the approach to like the aesthetics of well, of anything, right? That there was a very, it was highly influenced by a kind of, at least an echo of socialist realism, or that is to say, the like blunted aesthetics of production and a inevitable triumphal march to toward history. So yeah, any like examination of a like mythologized, like lost, like Paradise Lost approach to culture would read to these people as reactionary, because it's not the Boy Meets Tractor motif that says we're moving forward toward the, you know, the future.
And that's why Cohen would describe those folks as vulgar Marxists.
Yes.
So, yeah, that's a problem. Like Trotskyism, even the third campus Trotskyism that we came out of, treads dangerously close to Stalinist waters in a ton of different things.
Yeah.
And one of those just being the fact that Trotsky on literature and art is an incredibly unsophisticated take on literature and art, mm-hmm. and probably shouldn't be read by Marxists anymore, you know?
Or, I mean, you know, read as anything's read, but, like, it shouldn't be, you know, centered put on the front stage.
Right. It should be read the way everything else is read, but not the way that Trotsky is read.
Right, right? Exactly.
Which is to say, like, it shouldn't be read as a... like the way that, you know, a rabbi reads the Torah, or that a priest reads the first five books of the New Testament. You should just read it like it's any book.
Trotsky's whole argument in that is that the newly proletarianized peasantry of Russia didn't even have any exposure to bourgeois art, so how would they even have a foundation in creating proletarian art? Which, fair enough, right? That doesn't apply to us, you know.
I don't even think applied to the Russian proletariat.
That's what I was going to say. It's like even taken on its own terms. I don't even entirely buy the argument. But even if one were, but your point, I take your point, Chris. That even if one were to assume that point was valid, it doesn't apply anymore.
And this is a discussion that I had with Alex Billett on our on the feature interview that I did with him about Red Wedge magazine. I brought up Trotsky on literature and art. And he had a whole hell of a lot to say about that. And mm-hmm. I think that anybody who's interested in this subject should go back and listen to that, because it's a really, really interesting interview with a really smart guy who knows his shit.
Yeah, I just think in general that, like, whenever it comes to politics and art, you can never extract politics from anything, and you shouldn't try to. But the two are separate variables. It's like an X and Y axis on a graph. They interact and they create the point on the graph that you're looking at by their interaction, and so you can't extricate one from the other, but they're independent variables. They don't, you know, one doesn't determine the other.
I'm thinking about this notion of the valorization of the realm of a culture's ghosts, and like the way in which the bourgeoisie when it was a revolutionary class, it the language that it spoke in was the language of like resurrecting classical form, like in art, in literature, and in politics, right? Like, and it's not that they like literally tried to resurrect the Athenian concept of democracy. Well, in the United States, the American Republic was basically that, right? But like the French, they took the concept of a republic and they gave it a new character, but it was still a hearkening to. It's like man in his natural state. It's not meant to say that you know, not like in a Ted Kaczynski way, like go and actually live in the woods, right? But that the ideal to aspire to is unfettered development of the mind, of the spirit. You know, that's what freedom is about. So it's like an idealized notion of the past.
That's what folks among the European New Right would refer to as archaeofuturism. And that is just sort of trying to mentally construct the society that they would like to build. And that's one that harkens back to previous forms of pre-Enlightenment society projected into the future that exists as it is with mass production and mass media and digital media and everything else and technology. But in Marxism, the idealized past that is harkened back to is one that Marxists know that we cannot recreate. And that is, you know, primitive man living communally in small groupings. And we know that we can never recreate that, and we don't want to try to. But what we would like to do is create a society free of hierarchy and free of alienation from what it is that makes us human. And in doing so, we find it useful resurrect bits and pieces of our past to help us create an aesthetic and to help us be able to explain what it is that we would like. That's one thing that I saw someone mention, and I don't remember, it's probably in my notes, I can go back and find it, but called Gothic Marxism a salvage project, where we salvage the detritus of the past in order to help us create our vision of the future.
Mm. Yeah, that, you know, that it was the Lit Crit guy, which I wish I even knew his name. I just know him as the Lit Crit guy. But
shout out to the Lit Crit guy. He has been helpful in this discussion. We read a couple of his articles and listened to a couple of his interviews.
Yeah, I subscribed to the Horror Vanguard.
Horror Vanguard's great.
Yeah,
it's some low culture with some highbrow analysis, and I fucking dig it.
Yeah, I'm into it. But no, he said he made a point that it was like I think he was counterposing romantic literature more broadly, but maybe he was talking about Gothic specifically. But he was counterposing science fiction to Gothic as two genres, where science fiction is one that expands outward and looks forward. Whereas Gothic is a genre that closes inward and looks backward. Hmm. Now, I think that there's, you know, a sort of vulgar Marxist take on that is going to say, well, you know, individualism and history, you know, looking backwards, nostalgia for the past are bad. Social objectivism and the future is progressive, so that's good. So Gothic is bad, and science fiction is good. But I think the point that he was trying to make that I agreed with, either that he was trying to make this point or I just invented it in my head. But it was that, you know, the human being is multidimensional and has different sides to him or her, that is both an objective feature of social existence as well as a subjective internal existence. It has, and the human being has a history and it has a future. And to try to negate one in favor of the other is to misunderstand the project of Marxism, I think.
Well, it's to not think dialectically. So I would say it is to, like, exactly, completely miss the project of Marxism. A way that this could be maybe recentered in a way that would make sense for some people, I was thinking, was like the way in which, like, indigenous liberation movements, or, you know, movements for justice that have an indigenous base, don't necessarily and often, like, usually don't literally call for, like, the white settlers' descendants to be swept off the face of the earth and driven into the sea to take back the continent, you know, for the original inhabitants, because it would be a literal impossibility. And yet the pre-colonial epoch is a point of reference. It is the basis on which the future will be built, is this notion that it doesn't have to be the way that it is. And it does. I don't think that just strikes a person necessarily as immediately like Gothic, but it's certainly romantic. It's a romanticization, mm-hmm, of a lost past, and yet that, like, that sense of paradise lost is the thing that kind of keeps the flame of the notion, like, of a future paradise, you know, keeps it burning.
Yeah, and I think that an important point to make right off the bat is that Gothic Marxism and Marxist romanticism are inextricably linked, and that I would say that Gothic Marxism is like a subcategory of Marxist romanticism. But what I was just saying about detritus is point number two on the Marxist rubric of concerns, Gothic Marxist rubric of concern, is, and that is the valorization of a culture's detritus and trivia, as well as its strange and marginal practices, which I think brings us around to the topic of not brushing aside spiritual and occult practices within any given culture. And I think a pretty good example of that is the newfound affinity for witchcraft among many young radicals, of whom are Marxist and materialist in every other sense, other than that now they're neo-pagans all of a sudden.
It's rad, and I'm here for it.
Yeah. I'm absolutely here for city witch Marxism.
City witch Marxism is okay with us. We're totally down with that aesthetic. And, you know, I think that there is something that is very human in needing to find rituals to deal with things that we don't quite understand, like death and changes in life and things that we don't, that we might understand but don't deal with very well. Ritual is very important in all of that. And one of the things that a vulgar materialist analysis would have us do is to eschew ritual altogether, in a way that, like, when the after the Protestant Reformation, the nunneries were done away with, and veneration of the saints was done away with, and many of the rituals and feast days were done away with. And you can see, when examining the response of that by common people, they were violently opposed to it because they adored those rituals and they adored these little things, these little practices that they held onto. They adore them because they helped them cope.
It's almost like they were living in a heartless world, but they had found a heart.
Right. And there's just something that a sober, rational understanding of the world does not fulfill, that is deep within the human psyche.
Yeah. Well, also, whether, and for the sake of this conversation, I'm just going to keep calling them vulgar Marxists, whether they realize it or not, the framework that they're operating or that they're using is colonialist. And I don't want to compare them to, like, you know, a witch hunt, but I will say that, like, a lot of the things that initially led to historically accusing, namely women, of witchcraft, and even more so when you bring in race, is just that, like, people do not understand, you know, particular healing practices or traditions or rituals, because it's different and it's outside of their scope. So the thing that I think interests me most, I don't remember what we read or what we listened to, right? But someone mentioned that, like, what compels people so much about goth stuff, right? Like, why are people drawn to this, and how does it benefit us personally? Just gothic literature, gothic art, whatever, right? And one of the things they brought up was that it forces us to be introspective and think, why are we drawn to these monsters? Why do we have an interest in stuff that is more macabre or, you know, dark? Where does that come from? And it really, I think, requires a sense of, like, self-awareness and criticism that a lot of other folks don't have. And I think when you look at that within a Marxist framework, right, I think that applies also to the rigidity and orthodoxy of a lot of the ways we think about things. Yeah. So one of the first people, I'm going on a tangent and I'm not going to stop because otherwise I'm going to lose my place.
Go on.
And I think one of, you know, if not the first, you know, text that came to mind was Silvia Federici's Caliban and the Witch, because it is by and large, like, one of the first things I read that I would consider Gothic Marxism, and it's referenced in a lot of our resources that we used for this episode. But I think, you know, that introspection on our own views and a lot of the things that we've rehearsed when talking about reproductive labor and the oppression of women and the development of women's oppression, you know, coinciding with the development of class society, a lot of those things that are regularly rehearsed by Marxists, I think she has the ability to challenge. And I think that's because of the framework that she's operating under, you know, and I think that comes from, you know, the tendencies within, you know, what we would consider Gothic Marxism. You know, it forces you to like really re-examine these things, you know, when you kind of let go of some of the baggage of the orthodoxy of it all. I have a lot to say about Caliban and the Witch and about witchcraft, and a lot of scattered thoughts and notes, but I'm going to leave it at that for a little while.
I think you hit the nail on the head exactly when you said that it forces us to turn inward and introspect. Because I think that, frankly, I think that that's precisely the element that is latched onto by the far right in Gothic matters of interest, is that narrowness, the focus on the self, the individual, the sort of eschewing or refusal of the social and that which is outside of the self and the individual. And also a sort of anti-humanism, a hatred of of others, which I think also can be rendered in a certain light that can be progressive as well. But anyway, I think that that's an approach that fits easily without much work into a right-wing perspective. But it's, you know... nothing that is human is alien to me, right? Like, I am right. human, and nothing that is human is alien to me. I think that if we're gonna ever be able to have any hope of building a worldview or a framework that, like, actually speaks to human beings, we have to speak to all aspects of human beings, including the parts that may be more difficult or more demanding from like a leftist perspective.
Well, yeah, like I'm reminded of a episode we did. I forget the title. The episode we did about revolutionary pessimism, where we toward the end of the episode we all kind of like spoke a little bit to our own experience of being in an environment in which introspection and self-reflection and recalibration. And, you know, the confronting of the negative, the dark, the horror, the horrific was basically just like not done. And it was like anathema to what was considered to be like political practice.
Right.
And I think that the left has like the bourgeois revolution. I think that the socialist revolution as an ongoing, let's say, possibility has overcorrected in the direction of science, in the direction of the rationalist project. And we do so at a tremendous detriment to Kevin, like you said, the ability to connect with all that is human. I think it's interesting that like this topic of the Gothic or the Romantic and of pessimism, that they dovetail so neatly with what I think, you know, maybe this is the reason we've all kind of decided to come together and talk about these things, because there's this yearning for this thing that's been missing, that you sort of have a sense of, you know, that you know it needs to be there. And it's interesting that there are a lot of different languages to talk about the same thing.
So, and I think Western culture specifically, in between the medieval period and the late 19th century, because you definitely had a fascination with death in the medieval period. And, you know, especially during the Black Plague with the Danse Macabre depictions of that. And with the advent of Protestantism, you get this sort of fixation on the bright future that is offered up by salvation through Christ. Mm-hmm. And that makes its way into Enlightenment thought, but is translated into this linear path forward and the bright future that can exist if the correct elements are in place to build a new society, an enlightened society. And it sort of carries its way into Marxism in the same way, where we've still, as Marxists, are thinking of only good things. Because to think think upon anything that's evil is to invite evil into the soul, in a very, very Protestant sort of literal reading of the New Testament, you know. And it's still there. And, you know, Marx wasn't immune to it. And there's just so much shitty Protestantism that is in Marxism. And I think that this is a corrective for it. In the same way that we refer to ourselves as revolutionary pessimists, as a corrective against blind optimism, we can be Gothic Marxists as a corrective for this, for the exact same fucking thing. Yeah. This just fixation on a bright linear future that we're always reaching towards and never actually dealing with the possibility of death and failure.
Well, you know, I think that Marx had a pretty Gothic strain in him, at least a romantic strain. You know, he was fond of Goethe and Schiller. And I think it's like, it's the pulse.
Goethe slaps.
Yeah, Goethe slaps, man. And I think that that, you know, part of that's being, you know, being a German, being a philosopher, and having like it wasn't very far in the past when the Sturm und Drang was like a new concept. But it's mm-hmm. certainly by the time you get to like, you know, I hesitate to call it Orthodox Marxism, but like, you know, the period of like Kautsky and even late Engels and the like codification of like scientistic, that's the wrong word.
No, it's the right word.
Scientistic, scientism, right?
Yeah.
You know, it really bears the marks of the age of like the 1880s and 90s. And, you know, and it takes the First World War to kind of like pull the wool off everybody's eyes about like the march of progress. But the early Marxism of, you know, when they're, theorizing about alienation, and you know they're in between the revolutionary wave of 1848 and 1870. There is a deep introspection, so that's why I think like I accept the use of the term Gothic Marxism because it exists, and I'm not going to try to pretend like I can move around the words that people actually use. But I think that the Gothic strain in Marxism is what we're trying to like resuscitate, you know?
Right.
Because I don't think it's being grafted on. I think it's being drawn out, or that's the way, yeah.
And it makes sense. Oh. I think it was Adam Turrell's Red Wedge article. I wrote this down and my handwriting is terrible, and I'm pretty sure I paraphrased, but one of the notes I wrote down is that like the initial impetus was the marginalization of medieval forms by bourgeois relations and industrialization, right? So it makes sense that, you know, for us to be drawn to this sort of, at the very least, aesthetic, you know, right? But, you know, I think that there is a dialectical relationship for why, you know, women, for instance, are so drawn to this sort of stuff. And particularly, I think, in the moment we're in, why we've seen, and I think some people would hesitate to say this, but I know there's been a lot of discussion around it. Also, those people are probably kind of racist, whether they acknowledge it or not, this like rise of black Gothic tendencies right now and black Gothic art, you know. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of the, you know, folks that we're reading were talking about Get Out and like Gambino's, you know, art right now. And there are tons more examples, right? You know, I don't think it's a coincidence that most of the best Gothic literature is written by women, a lot of it by women of color. Certainly the best Southern Gothic literature is written by women. I think there is something about the way we experience oppression and exploitation that really lends itself
I agree.
To what we're talking about right now. So the rejection of it or scoffing at it like makes so little sense to me.
Yeah,
maybe that's just because I've literally been accused of being a witch. So,
hasn't it always been
so? Like in the Hocus Pocus, the craft sense, like
guilt.
I wish.
Just to underscore, I mean to back you up here, the birth of Gothic literature is said to have been a challenge given by Lord Byron to his friends. For everyone to write a Gothic novel in this dark summer, when I guess it was the summer that the Krakatoa explosion happened, and there was a cloud of ash that was blanketing, you know, Europe and making it dark and gloomy. So the Gothic novel was born out of a contest that was put on by Lord Byron. Four people were involved, and the only novel that we remember is Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
Right. Because she said, bet.
Right. So there's two...
Yeah.
There's two things about that that I think, you know, that little anecdote, that a lot can be drawn out of that. And the first is that, the point that you just made, which is that, like, the origins, you know, it's not just, like, from Mary Shelley to Anne Rice, like, these are the people whose names you remember for a reason, right? But the other one is that it's significant, and I think that the Gothic novel is born when the world is especially tough to deal with. It's really dark. It's not just the literal darkness of the Krakatoa explosion, but it's also like the entire social fabric in that moment. But it all comes together, and like the literary expression is really quite enduring even now. And I think like I had wanted to circle back to this for a little bit, but Kevin, you were talking about this notion that the Gothic turns inward and looks backward, and that the sci-fi novel looks outward and forward. And I think, like, to the extent that that's true, to the extent that I'm willing to accept, like, that framework, that dichotomy, it's only because some moments call for one over the other. The idea that it is inherently reactionary to look inward and backward is just as wrong as the idea that it's inherently progressive to look outward and forward, right? Just like fascism is futurist in certain aspects, but it's also horribly retrograde in others, right? And the same thing with the communist project. When it is at its most vibrant, it is both the construction of the future, right? The wrenching of joy from the future, but also it is on the basis of this, like, you know, the paradise lost of primitive communism.
I need to read number three of the Gothic Marxist rubric real quick.
Yes.
Because we've already moved well into its territory. A notion of critique moving beyond logical argument and the binary opposition of a phantasmagorical staging more closely resembling psychoanalytic therapy, privileging non-rational forms of working through and regulated by overdetermination rather than dialectics. And I think that...
it's a lot of words.
It is a lot of words. But the thing that I'm going to choose to fixate on right now is the sort of psychoanalytic approach to picking relevant pieces of information out of expressions of culture, using those to diagnose what it is that was being expressed by cultural productions. So in the Gothic literature of the 19th century, we can find all sorts of themes that have to do with the destruction of the sort of bucolic way of life that existed in the countryside of England, and forcing of peasant laborers who had toiled the land with their hands for, you know, thousands of years into factories, and the sort of just cheapness of life and the selling of workers' bodies that accompanied the primitive accumulation of capitalism in the Industrial Revolution. And a lot of that, I mean, everyone needs to read this book that I also grad school read for for this, is David McNally's Monsters of the Market, which is really, really good. And I need to go back and actual read it, because there's so much good stuff in there. I'm going to put in the show notes links to everything that we read, and bibliography of books, so that people can go and get a hold of those if they want to.
So I'll sort of use this interval to make a point that I really wanted to make, which is regarding a deconstruction of a vulgar materialism that Gothic Marxism is reacting against, right? So the entirety of Western philosophy, since modern Western philosophy is shot through with a dualism of idealism and materialism, a dichotomy. This dualism certainly has its antecedents before the modern era, but I mean, everything has its antecedents. Everything comes from the material that it was bequeathed to it. But it became the dichotomy that it is today, arising out of René Descartes' theorization of really, I mean, he was engaging in an endeavor of metaphysics. He was trying to say, like, how can metaphysics and epistemology, how can I know what is and how can I know what is? And reducing everything down to I think, therefore I am. That is the very, very fundamental essence of existence, which is that the fact that I am thinking something indicates that there is some sort of existence. It negates the possibility that nothing exists because something exists, which is my thoughts. So, you know, and his project bequeathed the rest of Western philosophy, which the entirety, even to this day, is shot through with a dualism between idealism and materialism. And it's that dualism that Marxism was sort of entering into when Marx was reacting to Hegel's idealism and saying, I'm flipping Hegel on his head and making a dialectical materialism rather than a dialectical idealism. An important critique of that dualism is to draw a sort of genealogy of where this dualism arose from so that we can sort of deconstruct it. The world that René Descartes was writing his theories and his speculations to was a world where the Catholic Church ruled everything, but the including naturalistic investigations. So it was in the monastic, you know, ivory towers of the monastic traditions where the Catholic Church was investigating into the natural world, conducting experiments, and venturing into this thing that became modern science. And some of this research, some of these monastic studies, were starting to turn up discoveries that were in conflict with the teachings of the Catholic Church. That was starting to create a very real problem, an idea, a sort of a contradiction, you might say, in the authority or the rule of the Catholic Church. And so the Catholic Church, so there needed to be someone who could, there needed to be an idea introduced that could, or a philosophy that could be introduced that would make sense of these, of this contradiction. So René Descartes came along and introduced the modern notion of the dualism or the dichotomy between materialism and idealism, where there is the natural material world on one side that operates according to mechanical principles and can be investigated through the natural sciences. And then on the other side, there is the spirit and the spiritual world that that God and angels and the Catholic Church has total rule over. And the two cannot interact. It is from Descartes' political project of creating space for the natural sciences that we've been bequeathed this unfortunate epistemological and metaphysical dualism that Western philosophy has forever been trying to overcome. And I think that it's very easy to read materialism as any form of materialism coming out, rising out of that Western philosophical tradition, as something that is accepting that that dualism as true, and then taking one side in it. I think that what Marx was actually doing was trying to, and forgive this postmodern phrasing, transcend that dichotomy. Was trying to say that the different aspects of existence are not inseparable, and trying to find a way to integrate them back into a singular existence.
Yeah, and that's why I think people like Walter Benjamin are so important to read as Marxists, even if you don't agree with every last one of their theories and ideas, but that a Gothic Marxist method probably starts with Benjamin more than anyone else. And I think that his sort of his ideas of his ideas of a profane illumination, of needing to create a sort of materialist illumination that is trying to get back to the same libidinal desires for illumination that are spoken to by religion, but that are not tied to the sort of reactionary, stultifying nature of organized religion, specifically the Catholic Church. And I guess he comes from a Jewish background and was best friends with Gershom Scholem, who is probably the most famous Kabbalist of all time. So he was involved in Jewish mysticism and sees the value in that sort of mystical exploration, and wants to try to find a Marxist outlet for that. And in doing so, he kind of re-Hegelianizes a little bit of Marxism, you know? And I think that's pretty
cool. Yeah, well,
I haven't read nearly enough Hegel, but reading Benjamin makes me want to read more Hegel.
Yeah.
But I was thinking about, like, you know, when the 1844 manuscripts kind of like come to light, and there begins to be this investigation, a deeper investigation into alienation as a concept. And there's like, you know, Marx still using a lot of Hegelian language and talking about species being, right? And, you know, people like Althusser kind of like reject it as like, oh, that's, you know, it's leftover German philosophy before the mature Marx becomes the kind of like the scientist, right? And then there are other people like Dostoevskaya who do the thing that people in Marxism do for some reason, where it's like, well,
yikes,
I'm a Marxist humanist, which is to say I recognize the humanist strain in Marxism and have carved out a space for that investigation. Similar to like, you know, well, I guess what we're doing, right, with Gothic Marxism. But like, again, I think it's there. You know, when we talk about this dualism that we inherited politically, philosophically, scientifically from, you know, say from the early days of the bourgeoisie, you know, because we live in their world, right? But I think that Marx at his best is a person who doesn't have to try very hard to like to seek out a more totalizing worldview, because it's a dialectical worldview and it's an intentionally... you know, he's constantly seeking to negate the negation, right? To like to he never did see, and I don't think that Marxism is really a worldview that sees completely independent spheres of existence. It never has, and it can't. And the minute that it becomes that, when it becomes a dualistic, I don't know, philosophy, a dualistic ideology, right? Then it ceases to retain that Hegelianism that is, you know, that from which Marxism comes. The scientific socialism of people like Karl Kautsky or of like Joseph Stalin, right? This very rigid wooden orthodoxy is in direct contradiction. It is. I would consider it an alien or a lopsided way of approaching the world. That has less and less to do with Marxism and more to do with more classically bourgeois modes of thinking.
Right. Yeah, that's in that book, The Meek and the Militant, it talks about vulgar atheism of the Enlightenment and the overcorrection of the Enlightenment, just demystifying and eschewing anything that couldn't be rationally explained in favor of a very mechanistic sort of scientism. But yeah, so yeah, that's a great book, The Meek and the Militant. And I don't remember who wrote it, but if I remember, I'll include it in the show notes because it's definitely worth reading. It's a Marxist text on religion. And one of the things that I remember from it is it sort of rehabilitates Marx's ideas of religion being the the heart of the heartless world, soul of soulless conditions, and, you know, truly the opiate of the peoples.
I have that and, tattooed on my chest.
The whole quote?
Yeah. Yeah, here.
Well, at least you got the whole, at least you got the whole quote and not just the...
Are you pulling an Adam Levine religion? Right now?
Yeah, I am.
Oh, he is.
Oh, it's no. Like, oh, not the whole paragraph. Just the last sentence.
The opiate of the peoples or the opiate of the masses?
Die religion ist das Opium des Volkes.
God damn.
So the, all four of us need to get a different section of that, like... overall passage so that we can stand next to each other and lift our shirts up and show our tattoos.
It's the Marxist equivalent of like a best friend's heart that like goes together necklace.
Yeah. Well, not just a Marxist, this would be a Gothic Marxist version because we're trying to rehabilitate the reverence for the fantastical.
Little boxes were safe and sound. They were not dead. They got to ground.